Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 30, which I will entitle A Lament for Egypt. Now, this word came to Ezekiel maybe at the same time as the previous prophecy, which was a prophecy of doom and gloom and destruction for Egypt in chapter 29. That last prophecy was in the 10th year of Jehoiachin's captivity, the 10th year from when Zedekiah was put on the throne by the Babylonians. That was in 597. So 597 minus 10 is 587. Precept Austin has 586. So somewhere around the time of the destruction of Babylon is when the last prophecy against Egypt came. Now, this prophecy was probably at about the same time. So somewhere around the time that Babylon destroyed Judah and the capital city of Jerusalem. So we start now in verses 1 through 5. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, prophesy and say, this is Yahweh speaking now, this is what the sovereign Lord says, wail and say, alas for that day, for the day is near, the day of the Lord is near, a day of clouds, a time of doom for the nations. A sword will come against Egypt, and anguish will come upon Cush. When the slain fall in Egypt, her wealth will be carried away, and her foundations torn down. Cush and Put, Lydia and all Arabia, Libya and the people of the covenant land will fall by the sword along with Egypt. That's the NIV translation. Now, first of all, we have to deal with the fact that God calls Ezekiel son of man in practically every chapter. I'd like to go back and check. I believe it's probably in every chapter he calls Ezekiel son of man. Why? Well, there are two theories. One is that son of man means that Ezekiel has the characteristics of a man, namely fallibility, weakness. And God wants Ezekiel to be humble. And so he says, you're nothing but a man, Ezekiel. I don't like that theory. I think the better theory is that God is actually creating a type, Jesus being the antitype, because Jesus called himself the Son of Man all the time, all the way through the Gospels. Jesus got the phrase from Daniel 7:14, which says, the Son of Man ascended up into the Ancient of Days, God the Father. Therefore, the Son of Man was understood by Old Testament Jews to refer to the Messiah, so Jesus appropriated the name to himself so that people would know that he was the Messiah. Now, how is Ezekiel a type of the Messiah? Well, Ezekiel is speaking to the rebellious house of Israel about the destruction of their temple. In 586, Jesus is speaking to the rebellious house of Israel, and he spoke about the destruction of their temple in AD 70 when he gave the Sermon on the Mount. So God says, Son of man, prophesy and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Again, God calls himself sovereign all the way through the book of Ezekiel. He's in charge of all these national movements and risings and fallings. The sovereign Lord says, wail and say, alas for that day, for the day is near, the day of the Lord is near. Now, the day of the Lord is a phrase that many modern eschatology aficionados love to bandy about, the day of the Lord. And, of course, what they're talking about is the end of the world. But here we see the day of the Lord is not referring to the end of the world, but rather to the end of Egypt. As we'll see in a minute, it's Egypt. And there are lots of examples where the day of the Lord just refers to a day of judgment, not necessarily a judgment on the whole world at the end of history. So the day of the Lord is near, a day of clouds. Clouds really showed up in Egypt. But according to this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar is going to show up in Egypt, and he's going to be a storm cloud. A time of doom for the nations. Well, what nations? I thought we were talking about Egypt. Well, it's all the nations that were allied with Egypt, which we'll see in just a minute. Cush, Put, Lydia, and so forth. Libya. Verse 4. A sword will come against Egypt. Now, this is later in the chapter said to refer to Nebuchadnezzar. In verse 10, Ezekiel 30, this is what the Lord God says. I will put an end to the hordes of Egypt by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Now, when this happened, unfortunately, is difficult to document for lack of historical evidence. I spent an awful lot of time in the last chapter going over this problem. I can't repeat it here. I would suggest you go back and listen to my podcast on Ezekiel chapter 29, and you will see I called it the most difficult chapter in the Bible. Perhaps an exaggeration, but it was difficult. And after that study and discussion, I assumed that the date for Nebuchadnezzar's invasion of Egypt was 568 B.C., around that time. That's during the time of the Pharaoh Amasis II. There are, in fact, records for that date as far as the fact of the invasion. As you can tell by reading the Wikipedia entry But there are no records for the complete annihilation of Egypt by Nebuchadnezzar. But I trust Ezekiel's prophecy. I'm sure that it happened. Now, a lot of conservative commentators say, well, we don't have any records for it, so it must be in the future. Well, I think it's much more likely that somebody just didn't dig up the proper clay tablet that told of what Nebuchadnezzar did to Amasis II in Egypt. So we're going to assume the veracity of Ezekiel's prophecy. According to my presuppositions, the prophets were speaking of God. You have your presuppositions, perhaps, that the prophets are not reliable. You probably don't have those presuppositions, but if you're a liberal and happen to be listening to this, you will have that presupposition. Well, you just go right ahead. I assume that Ezekiel is speaking the truth here. So in verse 4, a sword will come against Egypt, and anguish will come upon, now here all the allies are mentioned, the other nations, Cush, that's Ethiopia. Gil says of Cush, Ethiopia, being a neighboring nation to Egypt, shall be in a panic when it shall hear of the sword of the Chaldeans being in Egypt. The Chaldeans, of course, are the Babylonians. And of the ravages made by it, of the multitude slain with it, fearing it will be their turn next to fall into the same hands and in the same manner. And the rather, not only as they were neighbors, but allies. So Cush, Ethiopia, is going to be in anguish when the slain fall in Egypt. Her wealth will be carried away. Ethiopia's wealth will be her foundations torn down. Now, other allies besides Ethiopia are mentioned in verse 5. Cush and Put. That, of course, is Libya. Lydia is the country that was located in western Anatolia, western current-day Turkey, the last king of whom was Croesus, the man who was rich, as we say, rich as Croesus. And then all Arabia is mentioned. Now, there's a problem there, and before I discuss other translations of Arabia, let's go back to Lydia. Lydia is sometimes called Lud, L-U-D. Wikipedia says of Lydia, it was an Iron Age kingdom of Western Asia Minor, located generally east of ancient Ionia. Ionia, of course, are the Greek cities along the western coast of present-day Turkey. The kingdom of Lydia existed from about 1200 B.C. to 546 B.C. That's when Croesus, unfortunately, attacked Persia and got his rear end handed to him. So that's Lydia that was allied with Egypt. And now in verse 5, Arabia is also allied with Egypt. Now other translations have, instead of Arabia, translations such as the following. Holman Christian Study Bible, the various foreign troops, the ASV, the Darby, and the King James, all the mingled people, the Bible in Basic English, all the mixed people, the NIV, God's Word, and the New American Bible have it as the Libyans or Libya, which would be sort of repetitious because Put's already mentioned, so I guess those translations assume that Put's not Libya. Otherwise, it sounds pretty redundant. And then Young's literal translation has all the mixture. Well, I guess the NIV assumes that mingled people are people who are living out in Arabia, in the Arabian desert, and they are Bedouins, tribal folks wandering all over the place, and so they're called the mixed people. And, of course, they're right across the Red Sea from Egypt. So they would have the same problem. They would be allied with Egypt, and here comes Nebuchadnezzar. Libya is mentioned next in the NIV translation, and of course that's a problem because Put's already been mentioned in the first part of the verse. Well, actually, the Hebrew doesn't say Libya. It says Kub, C-U-B in transliteration. So Clark just calls them the Kubians, whoever they were. Holman Christian Standard Bible note says, literally Kub, Hebrew obscure. In other words, we don't know who those people are. And the people of the covenant land will fall by the sword along with Egypt. Now, who are the people of the covenant land? Well, there's a complete 50-50 split of opinion on that. Option number one, the covenant people of the land are the people of Israel, according to Albert Barnes. But then you would ask the question, why should they be in Egypt? Barnes answers that question. After the destruction of Jerusalem in 586, Jews withdrew into Egypt. As we know, of course, Jeremiah 43, verse 7. Many of them would naturally enough be found in the Egyptian armies, and so they would get wiped out. Well, here's an opinion that's contrary to that from Matthew Poole. Some refer to the Jews as children of the covenant, but this is forced. It is all the people of Egypt's league, all the allies of the Egyptian kingdom. In other words, that phrase would just sort of be a summary of all the other nations that were mentioned in particular, and so Ezekiel just finishes off by saying, and all the people who are allied with Egypt, catch all. There are some who say that the reference here is indeed to lands allied with Egypt and not to the people of Israel. Here's what the Cambridge Commentary says. Reference can hardly be to the land of Israel or to refugees from Israel and Egypt. Either some definite country is meant, or land is used collectively, all allied lands. The phrase says the people of the covenant land. I don't know, you hear covenant land, you tend to think of Israel. Well, here's an objection to the view that this reference is to Egyptian allies, and this reference is not to the people of Israel. Here's what Ellicott says. The objection made to this view that Palestine is never called the land of the covenant, the objection made to the view that the covenant land is Israel, Palestine, the objection made to this view that Palestine is never called the land of the covenant and that this must therefore signify some unknown country in alliance with Egypt at the time seems rather specious than real. If it happens that this expression is never used of Palestine, yet that was unquestionably the land of the people of the covenant. And a particular expression may very well be used once without occurring again. Well, on this weighty and momentous issue, I will leave it unresolved and report it and let you decide it. We go now to Ezekiel 30, verses 6 through 9. Yahweh is still speaking. This is what the Lord says. The allies of Egypt will fall and her proud strength will fail. From Migdal to Aswan, they will fall by the sword within her, declares the Sovereign Lord. They will be desolate among desolate lands, and their cities will lie among ruined cities. Then they will know that I am the Lord, when I set fire to Egypt and all her helpers are crushed. On that day messengers will go out from me in ships to frighten Cush out of her complacency. Anguish will take hold of them on the day of Egypt's doom, for it is sure to come. Now verse 6, the allies of Egypt will fail. And then from Migdal to Aswan, that's from the north of Egypt to the south of Egypt, they will fall. That sounds like the allies of Egypt will fall, or the inside of Egypt helping out against the Babylonians. That could very well be. Perhaps it's referring to the Egyptians themselves. But at any rate, Egypt and her allies are going to fall by the sword from Migdal to Aswan. Where is Migdal? If you look at a map, if you go to the extreme northeast of Egypt, to the desert of Shur, that little desert right there at the southeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea that connects Egypt and Israel. Migdal is right there about 20 miles from the Mediterranean coast, right there where the present Suez Canal is, running from the Mediterranean to the tip of the Red Sea and the Suez Gulf. And there's a road there running up from On, Heliopolis, present-day Cairo, where the seven branches of the Nile come together into the main trunk of the Nile River. So that road there from present-day Cairo on up to Migdal, heading up toward Israel, has Migdal on it, very close to the Mediterranean Sea. Then as you come back about 40 miles going back toward present-day Cairo is Tapanes. That's where Jeremiah and the Jewish refugees fled after 586 when the Babylonians had destroyed Jerusalem. So Migdal is at the very, very north of Egypt. Wikipedia says of Migdal that the word is a Hebrew word which means either a tower from its size or height, an elevated stage, a rostrum or pulpit, or a raised bed within a river. Physically, it can mean a fortified land, i.e. a walled city or castle, or elevated land as in a raised bed. Figuratively, it has connotations of proud authority. Okay, so Migdal. Now, we're going to see that Aswan is the same as the ancient Syene, S-Y-E-N-E. Please forgive me if I didn't pronounce that right. Syene is Aswan. It's at the far south of Egypt. Here's what Adam Clark says about Syene. Syene, now called Aswan, was the last city in Egypt, going towards Ethiopia. It was famous for a well into which the rays of the sun fell perpendicularly at midday. The famous interpreter Grotius translates this phrase as from Migdal, a fortress near Pelusium on the north of Suez, to Syene in the farther south. That is, from one end of Egypt to the other. Okay, so basically Ezekiel is saying, or God is saying through Ezekiel, from north to south, the destruction will be extensive. So in verse 7, Egypt will be desolate, cities will be ruined. Verse 8, they're going to know that Yahweh is Yahweh when they see all this disaster, when God sets fire to Egypt. Fire just means destruction, and her helpers are crushed. The helpers are the allied nations of Egypt. Verse 9, on that day, messengers will go out from me in ships to frighten Cush out of her complacency. So Cush is sitting fat and sassy, content, and all of a sudden ships come. These ships could optionally be three types of ships. Option number one, messenger ships to tell the people of Ethiopia that Egypt, their ally, has been destroyed, and so you're next. Or the ships, option number two, could be ships sent by the king of Babylon with messengers to demand a surrender of Ethiopia to Babylon. Or possibly the ships could carry Nebuchadnezzar himself, who marched to Ethiopia to subdue that country. We don't have historical records of that, but it's a reasonable speculation. At any rate, the ships are going to come, and Ethiopia is going to be very, very sad. Anguish will take hold of them on the day of Egypt's doom, says verse 9, for it is sure to come. We move now to Ezekiel 30, verses 10 through 12. Yahweh continues, "This is what the sovereign Lord says, I will put an end to the hordes of Egypt by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He and his army, the most ruthless of nations, will be brought in to destroy the land. They will draw their swords against Egypt and fill the land with the slain. I will dry up the streams of the Nile and sell the land to evil men. By the hand of foreigners I will lay waste the land and everything in it. I, the Lord, have spoken." Now, Yahweh in verse 10 refers to the population of Egypt as hordes. Egypt actually was extremely populated at that time. Nebuchadnezzar comes in and he's called the most ruthless of nations. Oh, yes, he was famous in ancient Near Eastern history for being ruthless. And so Nebuchadnezzar will fill up Egypt with dead people, with the slain. Verse 12, God will dry up the streams of the Nile. How would that happen? God would stop the rise of the Nile, which in turn would dry up the canals cut into the Nile for agriculture. That was very important to the Egyptians. They couldn't live without the Nile. The streams dried up, that means they die. God's going to take care of that. Now, that's easy to see. God controls the weather. I will dry up the streams of the Nile. Those were the canals cut from the Nile. Let me read you what John Gill says of this. Egypt was a country that abounded with rivers, however, with canals cut from the River Nile. Its wealth and riches very much depended hereon, partly on account of the multitude of fishes taken out of them and the paper reeds that grew upon their banks, but chiefly because the whole land was watered by them and made exceeding fruitful, rain being not so common in it, so that to dry up the river was in effect to take away their substance and dependence. Besides, hereby the way was made easy and passable for the enemy. That's something I didn't mention. Dry up the canals, Nebuchadnezzar can march into the center of Egypt very easily. Now in verse 12, Yahweh says he's going to sell Egypt to evil men, the evil men being the Babylonians. That's a metaphor referring to the delivery of the Egyptians to the Babylonians. We go down to Ezekiel 30, verses 13 through 16. Yahweh continues, "This is what the sovereign Lord says, I will destroy the idols and put an end to the images in Memphis." Now, of course, God's motive is to punish Egypt for how Egypt had treated Israel in the past, I'm sure. But one of his main motives is to destroy all those idols down there. "I will destroy the idols and put an end to the images in Memphis. No longer will there be a prince in Egypt, and I will spread fear throughout the land. I will lay waste Upper Egypt." Upper Egypt, of course, is southern Egypt. "Set fire to Zoan and inflict punishment on Thebes. I will pour out my wrath on Pelusium, the stronghold of Egypt, and cut off the hordes of Thebes. I will set fire to Egypt. Pelusium will writhe in agony. Thebes will be taken by storm. Memphis will be in constant distress." Now, a lot of Egyptian cities are mentioned here, and I think it's worthwhile to learn them because they show up a lot in the Old Testament prophets. Also, we'll see geographically they run from north to south. So again, the idea of the complete extent of the destruction of Egypt is thereby conveyed to us. Let's start with Memphis. The images of Memphis will be destroyed in verse 13. "Memphis was one of the most important cities of ancient Egypt," says Bible Guide. "At the head of the Nile Delta." The name Memphis means white. The name Memphis means white wall, or just wall. Memphis is about 20 miles south of present-day Cairo. Cairo is right where the seven branches of the Nile come together into the main trunk of the Nile River. You go a little bit south, past the Great Pyramids on the way, and then you hit Memphis. The KJV calls Memphis Nof. I don't know why. Here is an excerpt from a blogger called MyWanderLustyLife.com. "Today, Memphis, Egypt exists only as a city of ruins near a village called Mitrahina, less than 20 miles south of Cairo. The site was designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 1979 and spends its days as little more than a full-time archaeological dig. So that's Memphis today. Now in verse 14, after God says he's going to lay waste Upper Egypt in the south, then God says he's going to set fire to Zoan. Well, if you look at the map, I told you where Migdol was, at the far northeastern extremity of Egypt, on the road leading up from Egypt to Israel that runs up to the Mediterranean Sea and then hugs the Mediterranean coast. If you go about 40 miles due east of Migdol, on one of the branches of the Nile is Zoan. Both Migdol and Zoan are below Lake. Zoan is about 20 miles south of a big lake called Lake Menzela, which is a big lake right south of the Mediterranean Sea. Sort of butts into the Mediterranean Sea. Now we need to learn an alternate name for Zoan. It's sometimes called Tanis because in classical sources that's what they called it. Tanis, T-A-N-I-S. Assyrian records called it Sanu, and the Egyptians call it Sanat. But we'll just remember Zoan and Tanis. They're going to get set fire to. Now in verse 14 also, punishment will be laid by God on Thebes. Now Thebes is a very famous city. The King James translates it as No, N-O. Thebes is also known as No Amon. Let me read you from Bible Guide. Thebes is the capital of Upper Egypt, and in certain periods also the capital of the whole country. It's a very famous city. No Amon means the city of the god Amun, and this is how most of the references to it in the Bible should be understood. The identification of No Amon with Thebes, the center of the cult of the god Amun, is accepted by all. On the east bank, the huge temple complexes of modern Karnak and Luxor were erected, while on the west bank lie the necropolis and the funerary temples. The greatest building activities date to the reigns of Hatshepsut, Thutmosis III, and Amenophis III. Now, I know very little about Egyptian history, but I read a little bit on it, and Thebes is the place to go. In fact, I was planning to go there until COVID hit, that unfortunate virus, which leaked out of a Chinese lab, and which we were told came from a wet market in Wuhan, China. It messed up my trip, but I've seen a lot of pictures and YouTube videos and such. The necropolis is where they found the tomb of Tutankhamun. One of the famous tombs found here is that of Tutankhamun. Of great importance are the reliefs found in the tombs and temples, which illustrate the daily life and historic events of their time. So, lots of pharaohs buried on the west bank. Karnak, the biggest temple in the world, I think, of the ancient Near Eastern world. The thing's ugly as sin, if you ask me. It's not like a Greek temple, but it's full of inscriptions and paintings on the wall. Massive columns. Luxor is there also on the east bank. That place is so famous that there's a hotel in Las Vegas named after it. At any rate, Thebes is going to go down too. Now, if you look at the map, you go all the way down to the south as you head in south down the Nile River. You start with Abydos. I'm going to read some names. If you're familiar with Egyptian history, some of these places will be familiar. Abydos is mentioned a lot. And then you go on down the river, I don't know, another 100 miles or so, and you hit Thebes. Go down another couple hundred miles, you hit Edfu, which is also mentioned a lot in Egyptian history. Then you go down about another 300 miles, and you hit Syene. That's the southernmost city. That's present-day Aswan. It's right near the Elephantine Island, right next to Syene. Elephantine Island is very famous also. This is a fortress area, a border area. So Thebes was prominent in southern Egypt. Well, now Yahweh in verse 15 is going to turn from southern Egypt to go all the way back up to northern Egypt. I will pour out my wrath on Pelusium. Now, if you look at the map, Pelusium, also known as Sin, S-I-N, it's at the extreme end of the easternmost branch of the Nile River where that branch runs into the Mediterranean Sea. Here's what a dictionary I found. Actually, it was a website that was quoting Wikipedia, universalium.in-academic.com, says this of Pelusium, ancient Egyptian city located on what was once the easternmost mouth of the Nile River. Once. I just said that. I guess it's not there anymore, probably because of movements of the shoreline over the years. Pelusium's ruins lay southeast of modern Port Said, beginning in the 26th dynasty, circa 7th century BC, which is right before our time that we're talking about in Ezekiel. It was the main frontier fortress facing Palestine and was a customs post for Asian goods. In 525 BC, the Achaemenidian Persians under Cambyses II defeated the pharaoh Psamtik III there. That was sort of a turning point in history when the Persians took over the Egyptians. Big defeat there at Pelusium. In Roman times, it was a station on the trade route to the Red Sea because it's in this general area of the present-day Suez Canal that connects the Gulf of Suez, i.e. the Red Sea, to the Mediterranean Sea. Now, dropping back to verse 13, I skipped something. Yahweh says, no longer will there be a prince in Egypt. Now, what does that mean? There are a couple of optional ways to explain that. Option number one, there will no longer be a king who will rule in all of Egypt. Option number two is that there no longer would be a king ruling in Memphis. Gill mentions that as an option. I don't think that's it. I think it's talking about no longer would a king rule in all of Egypt. And I think that would be true starting from when Nebuchadnezzar came in, I'm speculating, in 568 B.C., wiped out Amasis II, and then Amasis II would rule all the way down to Psamtik III, who was right before Cambyses, who came in from Persia. But he would be ruling as a subordinate vassal king to Babylon. Here's what Gill says of this: no longer will there be a king. While when Egypt was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, it was under the Babylonians, and then under the Persians, and then under the Greeks, and afterwards under the Romans. After that, under the Saracens, that's the Muslims, and the Mamelukes, those were the Turks, and now in the hands of the Turks, the Ottomans, so that it never recovered its former glory. That's pretty much of a good solution to fulfillment of Ezekiel's prophecy. We go now to Ezekiel 30, verses 17 through 19. The young men of Heliopolis and Bubastis will fall by the sword, and the cities themselves will go into captivity. Dark will be the day at Tapanhes, when I break the yoke of Egypt. There her proud strength will come to an end. She will be covered with clouds, and her villages will go into captivity. So I will inflict punishment on Egypt, and they will know that I am the Lord. So once again, Yahweh is taking out after the cities of Egypt. He starts with Heliopolis. Heliopolis is also known as On. Heliopolis is the Greek name. Let me read you from Wikipedia. The ancient city of Heliopolis is currently located about 15 to 20 meters or 49 to 66 feet below the streets of the middle and lower class suburbs of Al-Matiriyah, Ain Shams, and Tel al-Hissan in northern Cairo. Please forgive the pronunciation. The area is about 1 mile west of the modern suburb which bears its name. So there's a suburb called On in Cairo. And remember, Cairo is right there where the seven branches of the Nile come together into the main trunk of the Nile River. There's a modern suburb called On, and the ancient city is underground between 49 and 66 feet. And it's underground about 1 mile west of the suburb which has the name On. That's easy to remember. So On is somewhere around present-day Cairo. Next, the people of Bubastis will fall by the sword. Now, this is an interesting city. This is from the Columbian Encyclopedia, and I got the quote from Answers.com. Bubastis is an ancient city, northeast Egypt, in the Nile Delta, near the modern Zagazig. Now, that's a great name for a city, Zagazig. Bubastis was capital of Egypt in the 22nd and 23rd dynasties. It began to decline after the second Persian conquest in 343 B.C., Bubastis was the center of the worship of the lion-headed or cat-headed goddess Bast. In the time of Herodotus, he's 6th century B.C., in the time of Herodotus, it had an annual Saturnalia, an orgiastic festival honoring the god Saturn. Great place. Had orgies, and they worshiped cats. As Pibaseth, Bubastis is mentioned in Ezekiel 30, verse 17. Well, the Hebrew is Pibaseth. The NIV just translates it as Bubastis, which I guess is what everybody calls it now. Wikipedia says of Bubastis, it is often identified with the biblical Pibaseth, quoting our verse here in Ezekiel 30, verse 17. It was the capital of its own nome. A nome is an administrative district of Egypt. It was the capital of its nome. It was located along the River Nile in the Delta region of Lower Egypt. Lower Egypt is northern Egypt. was notable as a center of worship for the feline goddess Bastet, and therefore the principal depositary in Egypt of mummies of cats. I guess mummies last a long time, so if you want to see a cat mummy, Bubastis is the place to go. Its ruins are located in the suburbs of the modern city of Zagazig. Now in verse 18, God says, dark will be the day at Tapines. Dark, of course, means doom and gloom. That's why they call it gloomy. It's dark because doom is coming. Dark will be the day at Tapines. Now Tapines, of course, is the famous place where Jerusalem and the Jeremiah and the exiles from Judah after the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem and conquered Judah in 586 B.C. Tapines is about 30, 40, maybe 35 or 40 miles southwest of Pelusium, which is right on the Mediterranean coast, as I just said. Migdol is roughly in between. So Pelusium, Migdol, and Tapines are in that region there, right at the edge of the land of Goshen, where the land of Goshen intersects the desert of Shur, right in the area where the present-day Suez Canal is. Now, at the end of verse 18, God says that Tapines, Egypt, will be covered with clouds. Remember, there were not a lot of clouds in Egypt, so when Egyptians saw dark storm clouds, they're thinking, ooh, this is not good. Her villages will go into captivity. The Hebrew there is her daughters, but that's a typical metaphor for villages around a capital city. It's all over the Old Testament, so we're going to assume it's villages like the NIV has it translated. Some people have said it could be actual daughters of Egypt will be taken into captivity. I don't think so. Verse 19, so I will inflict punishment on Egypt, and they will know that I am the Lord. That phrase occurs an awful lot in the midst of all these judgments on pagan nations, so that they will know that I am the Lord. There's a reason for it. We go now to Ezekiel 30, verses 20 through 26, and we will finish this chapter. In the 11th year, in the first month, on the 7th day, the word of the Lord came to me. So this is another prophecy. Ezekiel speaking there. And now here is Yahweh speaking again. Son of man, this is what Yahweh always calls Ezekiel. I have broken the arm of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. It has not been bound up for healing or put in a splint so as to become strong enough to hold a sword. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against Pharaoh, king of Egypt. I will break both his arm, the good arm as well as the broken one, and make the sword fall from his hand. I will disperse the Egyptians among the nations and scatter them through the countries. I will strengthen the arms of the king of Babylon and put my sword in his hand. But I will break the arms of Pharaoh, and he will groan before him, before the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. He will groan before him like a mortally wounded man. I will strengthen the arms of the king of Babylon, but the arms of Pharaoh will fall limp. Then they will know that I am the Lord. There's that phrase again. When I put my sword into the hand of the king of Babylon and he brandishes it against Egypt, I will disperse the Egyptians among the nations and scatter them through the countries. Then they will know that I am the Lord. There's that phrase again. Judgment tends to make people think about God. Not always. Now, when was this prophecy given? It was given a year later than the prophecy given in the first 19 verses of Ezekiel 30. The 11th year, that means the 11th year of Zedekiah's reign, the 11th year of Ezekiel's captivity, the 11th year of Jehoiachin's captivity, which was 597. So 597 minus 11 is 586. Verses 1 through 19 was probably a prophecy given in 587, the year before. The dates are, of course, rough, but it's somewhere around near the beginning of the destruction of Jerusalem in 586. The prophecy was given in the first month, Nisan 7, 7 days before Passover. Now, who is this Pharaoh who's going to have both his arms broken, one arm broken twice? If my dating is correct, that Nebuchadnezzar attacked Egypt in 568, as I reasoned to in the last chapter, and as Wikipedia and the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, they both say that there's evidence that Nebuchadnezzar attacked in 568. Well, the Pharaoh in 568 is Amasis II, who took out Hofra in 570. So, again, these dates are speculative. I'm doing the best I can. It's an interesting metaphor here. I mean, the Pharaoh has had one arm broken, and Yahweh did that in verse 21. But then, in verse 21, nobody bound up the wound or put the broken arm in a splint. So, Pharaoh's so weak he can't hold a sword. And if that wasn't bad enough. Then God came against him and broke both his arms, the good one as well as the broken one. So the good arm is broken for the first time, and the broken one's broken for the second time. It's a great metaphor. Real easy to see what God's doing here. Verse 23, God says he will disperse the Egyptians among the nations. That, of course, is all the nations of the ancient Near East, the several provinces of the Babylonian Empire. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with this lament for Egypt in Ezekiel chapter 30, and we're now prepared to go in our next audio to Ezekiel chapter 31, which I will entitle Pharaoh to be slain. I guess things aren't bad enough in Ezekiel 30. They're going to get worse in Ezekiel 31 for the poor nation of Egypt. Hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.